Okay, everything you wanted to know about product labeling and product information but were afraid to ask. Brief introduction of the topics that we'll be covering. We've split them into five. I will lead with the regulatory obligations and risk, which will be an overview of the sector-specific regulations around product labeling and product information, and the general regulations. That will be the who is responsible, what they're responsible for, etc., etc. We'll then move into one of the sector-specific areas, which is food. Food is a very important and highly regulated area for obvious reasons, and it has sadly led to some of the more tragic adverse reactions, especially around allergens. So that's another reason which we'll focus on it and look at a case study. We're also then going to look at CBD in cannabis products, because it's an increasingly controversial and fast-moving developing area. So we'll consider some of the issues around the labeling and safety issues around those products. We'll then move to litigation risks generally, so away from the regulatory sphere, but into more consumer actions. We'll consider the prospects of class actions and also contractual disputes that can arise in the supply chain. And finally, we'll do a little bit of crystal ball gazing as to the future and what developments are likely, including in relation to Brexit. So in terms of, sorry, I think I advanced one slide too many. In terms of the why, as we put at the top of that slide, we have regulatory provisions on product labeling and product information. It really does come at its core down to product safety. That's what the regulations are principally trying to ensure. But they also try to ensure more broadly that consumers are protected in relation to things like misleading, inaccurate statements and false advertising. And that's something we'll come to later in the presentation. But remaining focused on the safety, primary safety risks, traceability of products so that you can take effective corrective action, including recalls, that is probably one of the most important labeling and product information items that you could have. And you'll see there we've got the barcode image. Clearly, if a product safety issue is reported, then it's going to be very important to be able to respond swiftly. And if there are millions of products on the market, being able to say, well, the product that has a defect reported in relation to it came from this batch run on this Thursday afternoon in this factory, that's going to be extremely helpful in trying to isolate practically what the potential risks arising from that product report. In terms of the consequences of not getting this right, of course, there'll be very serious consequences, potentially for the consumers, that's you and me, if a product defect issue has arisen. So it's very important to protect the consumers, but also it's very important to protect the companies involved from criminal sanctions and fines, which can follow from breach and non-compliance. And finally, as mentioned again, litigation risks, particular product liability risks, consumer actions.
John, just to pick up on that issue of traceability and the importance you said that it's important that people place upon it, what happens if a product is very small, too small to put a barcode on it or to put information on it? How do you deal with that?
That's a very good question. Thank you, Nick. Well, it's always important. Ideally, you would place any markings on the product themselves, because for traceability, that is where the information should be, because it's on the product. People lose packaging, they throw away information, etc. So ideally, put it on the product. Of course, if it's a screw or if it's a contact lens, clearly it's impractical to put any detailed information on either of those products. So in such cases, product information associated on the labeling or with the product suffices. I'll try and click once, advance once. So the relevant regimes, as mentioned, there are various sector, product sector specific regimes and there is a general regime to sort of be a catch-all. And so some of the sectors are mentioned there, so food, cosmetics, medicines, toys, tobacco. For all of these sectors, you can see that they're all very important, for instance, toys, because of the particularly vulnerable users. And that's why they have their own regulations, and they're very detailed as to and prescriptive as to what must be done with the product for them to have compliance with the regime. And then there is the general product safety regime, which basically picks up for all the other products that haven't got a specific regime. And in respect of those products, there is a very vague obligation that they must be safe. And what that means is as not dangerous and as safe as the reasonable consumer is entitled to expect. Now, the relevance of product information and product labelling in that context is where there are particular risks associated with products that are known. It doesn't necessarily mean they can't be sold, but you provide information with them, or you provide warnings with them, and that enables the consumer to make an informed choice. Obviously, if they haven't had that opportunity to make the informed choice, then they haven't fairly assumed the risk.
John, if there are a specific set of regulations, but there appears to be a clash or a gap with the general regulations, how do you resolve that?
Well, that is a question, thanks Anna, that comes up a lot. Generally speaking, companies are advised to err on the side of safety, and if there is any conflict between, you know, where does a product properly sit in terms of is it in one sector or another, and the sectors can be quite fluid. So you will find, as we'll come on to discuss, that certain products may be regarded as food products but may not. Certain products may be regarded as medicines or not. Certain products may be regarded as medical devices or cosmetics. So they do jump around a little bit. But there are three particular sector-specific regimes, which are pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and food, for which they are the last word, and you're not supposed to look at any other regulations, including the general regulations, if you're looking at those particular regulations. But other than that, you should have regard to the general product safety regulations, but overall ensure that put safety first. I was going to just mention that, for instance, in terms of that fluidity of products in the different sectors, contact lenses is a very good example. Contact lenses that are called zero powered or non-prescription contact lenses, so coloured contact lenses purely to just alter your appearance, they are currently regulated as cosmetics, but from May of this year they will be considered to be medical devices along with the prescription contact lenses. So you do get these little sort of complications. And then in terms of the information that's actually required to be provided to consumers according to the different sector-specific regimes, there's general information which you'll find pretty much across all of the regimes, which will be manufacturer's name and address, and as coming back to the being traceability, batch numbers and serial numbers to identify the product. But there'll also be other symbols and pictograms that are put on products. So, for instance, the wheelie bin that's crossed out comes from the Waste Electrical and Electronic Equipment Directive, which is all about recycling of electronic and electric products at the end of their life. And the most important marking, labelling that goes on products, and we've been using for over 40 years, is the CE mark, which basically marks and demonstrates conformity and safety with a relevant regulatory regime. And we're going to come on to later, Nick is going to look at whether that CE marking regime will continue or whether it's going to change post-Brexit. But then moving on to information, product information and product labelling particularly, you'll see there we've got some examples. We've got a nice red chainsaw and we've got a smoking kills warning from a tobacco product. And in terms of warnings and information, it's obvious that there will be certain products that are inherently dangerous, but because they are deemed to be required for work, such as the chainsaw, or tobacco products for adults, if they choose to smoke despite being aware of the health risks, that they are regarded as being at liberty to do so. But what's important is that any choices that are made are informed ones. So that's why the information must be there. you'll see on the just beside the other side of the Smoking Kills sign, the McDonald's cup. Now, McDonald's took the decision to put caution contents hot on their coffee cups. That followed an action against the company from 1994 in the US state of New Mexico, where a damages award in the hundreds of millions was provided by a jury to an elderly lady who had dropped a hot cup of coffee into her lap. Now, a lot of people laughed about that at the time and thought, not obviously the lady being scalded, but the fact that McDonald's had put the warning on the cup, and that was a just a precautionary measure. I mean, I suppose it didn't cost them a great deal to do that. And their main motivation, even though there was no regulatory obligation, was to protect against such claims because the consumers had been warned.
Do all products require a CE mark?
No, all products don't require a CE mark. That is a common misconception. It's only the products that are where there are specific regulations for them, and then they'll have to go through a particular conformity assessment process, and then they can put the CE mark on. And in fact, some product producers have put a CE mark on when they weren't they weren't following a particular sector-specific requirement to do so, and that was held to be unlawful because they were trying to essentially false advertise, and it was misleading to consumers. So, finally from me, who is responsible? Well, as mentioned earlier, the primary safety obligation rests with the producer, as defined in the various different general and sector-specific regulations. Traditionally, the manufacturer would have been the producer, but increasingly, and that's why we have the boat or the ship with the containers on it image, goods come from outside the EU, and in that instance, where the regulatory authorities can't easily hold the manufacturer accountable, the producer becomes typically the importer or the authorised representative of the manufacturer or any entities that have decided to put their brand on the product. They will assume producer liability by dint of that. Or indeed anybody in the supply chain that takes any steps that will affect the safety properties of a product. And there are various different ways in which the safety properties of a product could be affected.
Just picking up on there, it's fairly common for products to be imported from China, let's say. What happens if, as the distributor, the only step I've taken is to simply translate the label or the information that comes with the product from Chinese into English? What happens there? Do I have any liability?
Yes, and that is often something that happens, especially something perhaps as ostensibly straightforward as translating instructions that have come from the actual manufacturer, but they've translated them into the market, the language of the market in which they'll be sold. That has been deemed to be taking a step which is affecting the safety properties, and the parties that take that step unwittingly then take on the producer responsibility, which is the primary obligation to make sure the product is safe, rather than having a lesser responsibility distributing the product.
Thank you, John. Well, I'm now going to pick up on food products and giving an insight and also a case study, which John's already referenced earlier. Now, of course, we're diving into a specific sector, but the reason we're doing so is because there are broader lessons to be taken from looking at the particular issues that arise with product information and product labelling in the food sector. And why focus on food? Well, it's a very interesting and highly regulated area, especially in respect of information and labelling requirements, which is understandable given that as an end consumer, you are actually consuming the product, for want of a better phrase. And secondly, you can draw a lot of parallels from the food sector across many sectors. And we have this case study, which hopefully will help to highlight some of the key points to take away. So the relevant regime, as with many sectors in the product liability and safety space, is predominantly derived from EU law. And of course, there's a wealth of regulations that apply to the food sector. I've drawn out and listed a couple of them on the slides, which are particularly pertinent in the context of product information, product labelling. Regulation EU 1169/2011 on the provision of food information to consumers, and of course the UK regulation, which is the Food Information Regulations 2014. Now, the relevant body for enforcement in the UK is the Food Standards Agency, with the exception of Scotland, who have their own body, which is the Food Standards Scotland Agency, because, of course, this is one of the devolved competences. The FSA's role is to ensure, as is a consistent thread throughout this presentation, the safety of the products, and to ensure, secondly, that the food is what it says it is. And then, of course, at the EU level, as in the image there, you have the European Food Safety Authority as well. Now, what are the requirements for food products? We've already said they're extensive. As with all of the products that have information and labelling requirements, we've already said the key is to ensure they're safe. So food must not be placed on the market if it is unsafe. And within that definition of safety, there is a requirement for information to be supplied to the consumer. And the exact requirements depend on the nature of the role that you are performing in providing that information and the context in which you're supplying that product. Firstly, it's worth noting that there is an extremely broad definition of food within the relevant regulations. And this defines it as any substance or product, whether processed, partially processed, or unprocessed, which is intended to be or reasonably expected to be ingested by humans. So you can see that's a very broad definition, and that leads to some surprising results as to what is actually covered by the definition of food for the purposes of these regulations. It includes drinks. Perhaps slightly surprisingly, it includes chewing gum. Of course, you're not meant to swallow chewing gum. And it includes any substance, including water, that is added to food in the manufacturing slash treatment process. However, it does not cover products that fall within one of the product-specific regimes that John has already mentioned, for example, medicinal products or tobacco as well has its own separate regime. In addition to this, foods with a health claim and medicines, which Hannah will come on to talk about later, are covered by a separate regime as well. And if you make a health claim, or if a food product has health effects, which Hannah will explain further later, then you fall outside of the food regime. And this is a further example of the fluidity between the various sectors here, which John has alluded to. Now, the mandatory information that is required is extensive. It includes a list of ingredients, instructions for use where necessary, and there are voluntary and mandatory nutritional indications. In addition to this, very importantly, you have 14 specific allergens which are stipulated by European regulations, which you have to identify. We've included a graphic of those, of which sesame is particularly pertinent because it's directly relevant to the case study that we're going to come on. Now, one of the key points as well to draw out here is that there is a distinction between products that are pre-packaged, i.e. those which are manufactured in a factory and packaged prior to delivery to the business, and those which are prepared in store. And again, we'll come on to talk about why there is this distinction and how it's relevant for the case study in a moment.
So, Nick, in relation to the
the 14 allergens that have been stipulated and appear in lovely colours on the slide. What if a food producer has concerns based on some post-market feedback that's arrived or some other research they have conducted which suggests that actually there's a 15th or a 16th allergen which is actually quite questionable? What should they do? Can they ignore that because it's not within the 14?
Well, that's an interesting question, and actually Hannah will come on to talk about how there are, in respect of cosmetics, a greater number of prescribed allergens which must be listed. So, of course, it's entirely possible that there might be something within your product which isn't listed within the specific 14 types, but nonetheless, as part of your overall obligations to ensure that you are putting on the market a product which is safe, which again includes the information requirements, you as a responsible business will have to consider carefully whether this is something that ought to be brought to the attention of consumers. And if you've been having reports of the specific ingredient within your product causing issues, then as part of any sensible corrective plan, then you should be considering the risks associated with that and whether you need to make any adjustments to the packaging, labelling, information, or indeed to the product itself.
That's it.
And that ties us neatly in with who is responsible. Under the regulations, they list the Food Business Operator, or FBO, as being the relevant entity which is responsible. But what does this mean? Well, the regulations state that an FBO is the operator under whose name or business the food is marketed, or if the operator itself is not established within the EU, the importer into the union market. And this is consistent with other regulations in this area and the concept of first placing on the market in the EU, which you'll be well familiar with if you're operating in this space. The key obligations on the FBO are, as we've already discussed, safety, ensuring that the product itself is safe. You're responsible at all stages throughout the life cycle of the product for ensuring that it is safe, and that includes this corrective action that we've just discussed. Traceability, again, going back to the barcode we showed in an earlier slide, it is very important that you have provisions in place and identifying marks on your product to ensure that you can identify where products end up. Transparency, emergency, and cooperation with downstream sellers are some of the other many responsibilities that fall onto FBOs.
So Nick, in the context of white label or own branded goods, let's take the example of Kellogg's cornflakes. Kellogg's make their own branded cornflakes, but they also make cornflakes for supermarkets. We can think of lots of different supermarkets. We won't promote any in particular. Who has the responsibility for the safety of those products? Does it all switch immediately from one to the other?
Again, this is a good question and one which manufacturers should always bear in mind, because even if you are selling downstream to the ultimate person who's going to put their labelling and trademark on the product, liability runs concurrently for both the manufacturer and the distributor. So you therefore remain effectively on the hook for products which you have produced, notwithstanding the fact that your branding may not be on it. In that context, the regulator may well look to you if, say for example, the downstream seller becomes insolvent, because of course the regulator will want to ensure that the end consumer has some kind of route to obtain compensation or reparation. And in this context, a prudent manufacturer will take steps to ensure that it performs thorough due diligence upon any ultimate seller of its products, including looking at the proposed labelling, packaging or information, and secondly to ensure that any liability that it may have is appropriately covered off, both by way of the commercial agreements it puts in place with appropriate warranties and indemnities, and also through obtaining insurance.
Very good, thanks.
So now on to the case study, which we've mentioned a couple of times already. And many of you will already be familiar with the tragic case of Natasha Ednan Laperouse, who suffered an allergic reaction after consuming a Pret baguette due to her severe sesame allergy. Now, the reason this was a controversial issue is because Pret didn't put labelling or information in relation to allergens on its products, on its sandwiches, because it availed of an exemption within the regulations, which provided, as referred earlier, that if you are producing products in the shop and packaging them on site, then you did not have to, and presently do not have to, put labelling or packaging information. Now, as a consequence of this, Natasha was unfortunately completely unaware of the allergen ingredient being contained in the baguette, consumed it, and tragically died as a result. In the aftermath of this, of course, this happened back in 2016, there was a coroner's report in 2018, which was fairly damning of Pret's actions and its operation in a grey area. Now, Pret sought to put forward several arguments stating that it had legitimate concerns as to putting labels on products and not being able to accurately forecast whether there was any cross-contamination in relation to products produced on site. But this found little truck with the coroner. Now, the implications of all this is that it's led to a law which has been dubbed Natasha's Law, which means that from October 2021 of this year, even those producers which are preparing sandwiches on site and packaging them will have to comply with all the mandatory information requirements we referred earlier. There is still an exemption for the kind of Subway type shop where it is still prepared over the counter in front of you. Why is this important? Well, living in grey areas is a risky approach to take. The reality is that the exemption that Pret availed of was only really designed for the sole trader type sandwich shop and not for a national food chain with circa 500 plus stores. And I think that's why Pret found little sympathy with the coroner and found little way to justify its actions to the coroner. And in particular, we understand that Pret was aware of perhaps 9 instances prior to this where there had been near misses. And in that instance, it's probably reasonable to say that Pret ought to have, if it did not, conducted a thorough review and considered whether corrective action was necessary. Now, after this coroner's report, Pret has voluntarily taken the step, as of the end of last year, to put in place all of the mandatory information in advance of the October deadline. What are the implications? Well, sadly for Natasha, and in fact for another individual, they suffered very tragic consequences. For Pret itself, it's difficult to say what the direct financial implications are. Certainly reputationally, it has had an impact. There was a lot of adverse publicity, and the latest financial forecasts show a decreased level of profits, but of course there are so many factors that it's impossible to state what that whether there's one single cause of that. For other food business operators, the FBOs, well, as of October this year, they are going to have to comply with Natasha's law.
So, Nick, why didn't the general product safety regulations apply in this context?
Well, that, yeah, it's an interesting point in terms of the corrective action I've just referred to. John's already set out earlier on that food is carved out from the GPSR. But that notwithstanding, within the food regulations themselves, there are provisions which require you, as we've just discussed, to put safety as a paramount and to ensure that any product that you put on the market is safe, including as regards the information supplied. So in the context of PRET, where they'd had 9 prior near misses, that's where the kind of corrective action plan comes in, considering what, if any, steps need to be taken.
Okay, so now let's look at product labelling and product information in the context of CBD products. So firstly, what is CBD? CBD is an abbreviation for cannabidiol, which is a chemical compound found in cannabis. CBD is available in a range of products, including sweets, tea bags, body wash, shampoo, and so on. Despite all the hype, the legal treatment around CBD is unclear and confusing, and the regulation has been somewhat left behind. Unlike some of the other controversial products already available on the market, such as tobacco and alcohol, CBD is not subject to its own specific regime. Instead, CBD products are regulated in accordance with the type of product that it is. For example, CBD vape liquid will be subject to the tobacco and other related products regulations.
So, I mean, obviously a controversial product range, and in the absence of any specific regulations, how are the producers, what guidance is there for producers, or how are they supposed to know what product information they should put on the product?
Well, there is no set guidance, so really the best thing a producer can do is just take a cautious approach and include as much information as possible on their products. Producers should also keep abreast of any developments from regulators. For example, and I'll come on to this in a bit more detail in a moment, but the FSA have released recent guidance and advice to consumers on the safety of CBD, and it's that type of information that producers should be using and thinking about incorporating onto their packaging.
Brilliant, thanks.
Okay, so now turning to look at CBD food products. Some of the most popular CBD products are these food-based products. For example, CBD gummy sweets and CBD oils. As there is no clear specific CBD regime, a lot of producers have been looking to food laws for guidance on product labelling and product information requirements, which include some of the considerations that Nick touched upon earlier, for example, including allergens on pre-packed products and so on. As some of you will be aware, last year the European Union categorised CBD food-based products as novel foods. Without going into too much detail, a novel food is a food that is considered not to have been consumed to a significant extent prior to the 15th of May 1997. So other novel foods include chia seeds and quinoa. The effect of this status is that novel foods must be authorised before they can be placed on the European market. So whilst this decision from the European Union is only advisory, and it is then up to the discretion of the member states to decide whether to enforce that decision. After sitting on the fence for quite a while, the FSA have now confirmed that they're accepting this position, and all producers of CBD food-related products must seek authorisation to be able to sell their CBD food products on the market after March 2021. the FSA have helpfully clarified that this does only apply to food products.
So back in January of last year, after the European Union decision, as you said, the FSA in the UK put a fairly bland statement out. Why do you think it's now come out and provided specific advice and information regarding labelling and taken a position?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it certainly is interesting timing, given that we formally left the EU just a couple of weeks ago. So it seems to me that perhaps the FSA knew the stance that they were going to take, being the adoption of the European model, but were perhaps waiting to see how negotiations panned out. And then being, as it were, and leaving the EU, they have now properly confirmed and enforced the European model. And as far as we're aware, we understand that the authorisation process will be the same as the European model. But in addition to that, the guidance does also refer to some potential harmful implications of using CBD. So that might have also been another prompt for them to act. Looking at other implications of the FSA's decision on product labelling and product information, the product labelling and information of a product will be a key component in the assessment during that authorisation process, whether that product is safe. So, for example, a prudent producer will look at the guidance and take note of the FSA's advice to consumers and incorporate that into their labelling. So, for example, the FSA have advised consumers that healthy adults should not be consuming more than 70 milligrams of CBD a day, and some vulnerable groups, including pregnant women, should not be consuming CBD at all. How prominent those warnings should be will, of course, be a commercial decision for the companies concerned. So if we now take a look at some CBD products in the cosmetics regime. So cosmetics have their own product-specific regime, which is noted on the slide. This is enforced in the UK by the Cosmetic Toiletry and Perfumery Association Limited. And again, the overriding objective of the regulations is to ensure that all products, cosmetic products that are placed on the market, are safe for use, which will involve ensuring that producers are providing consumers with appropriate information as to its safety. There are, of course, some mandatory requirements which can be found in the regulations, which producers need to take note of. And this will apply to all CBD products that are cosmetic in nature. So, for example, the body wash and CBD shampoo. So an interesting requirement under the cosmetics regime is the requirement of listing allergens on the product. So similar to the food regime, producers must list allergens on the packaging or labelling, but differing, instead of there being 14 allergens with the food regime, there are actually 26 allergens that are relevant to the cosmetics regime. And another difference is these allergens only need to be disclosed where certain thresholds are met, although you should note that these thresholds are quite low.
Let's say I have an adverse reaction to a cosmetics product that I've bought. I mean, my natural instinct is to go back to the place where I bought it, let's say, for the sake of argument, to Boots. What does the retailer have to do in that scenario? What obligations do they actually have?
Well, if the safety of the product has been called into question by the consumer complaint, then the retailer should make sure to notify the supplier of the incident and the possibility that the product isn't safe. Where you can't easily contact the supplier, then the retailer might go to the local trading standard services, but it certainly does need reporting. And if they don't report it or notify the relevant person, then they might become liable for consumer harm or damage to property. I guess in extreme circumstances, another consideration will be for the retailer to decide whether they should withdraw the product from the market and take it off the shelves. they might decide that they can continue providing the product to consumers, but needing to add some extra information to render that product safe. But the main principle for retailers to bear in mind is that they should not be selling products that they know or should know is unsafe. Okay, so there is a separate regime for human health products. Again, the underlying objective of the regime is to ensure that all of the products are safe. So products that fall within this regime must undergo an onerous authorization process. So that is that the products must be authorized by the competent authority in this area before they can be placed onto the market. And that process will involve putting the products through various trials and assessments. The competent authority in this area is the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency. And as with other products, there are rules on labelling and product information that can be found within the regime. So products will fall into this regime if, firstly, if the products have a medicinal effect, and that applies whether or not the product mentions that medicinal effect on its labelling or packaging. Or secondly, if the producer has made health claims on the product, and that's whether the product is medicinal in effect or not. So whether the health claim is true or not, they will be subject to that regime.
Sorry, Hannah, I was just going to ask a question on medicines, or in particular, what's a health claim? If making a health claim makes it a medicine, what's a health claim?
So a health claim is any statement that's made about the relationship between food and health. So health claims can be authorised, but only where backed by scientific evidence, and they must be easily understood by consumers. So, for example, a health claim might be to say that the CBD food in question can treat depression, for example. So bearing all this in mind, for businesses, it's really important that they do not make health claims on their products unless they are medicinal, unless they have medicinal effects, because they will unwittingly have fallen into this regime and their products will have to go through the authorization process and undergo medical trials to make sure that there is adequate scientific evidence for those health claims to be validated. So I guess looking at CBD specifically is a very grey area. It has been said by people that CBD has medicinal effects, so can be used to soothe chronic pain and to treat anxiety. And many people consume it for that reason. But officially, CBD has not been recognised as a medicine or a product with medicinal effect. So therefore, it wouldn't necessarily fall into this regime. However, it is worth noting that the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency had previously categorised CBD as a medicine and later withdrew the statement. So this is something that might change again in future. CBD products for animals and pets, in contrast, are considered to be medicines and they do have to undergo an assessment and be authorised to be placed on the market. So in light of that, producers should keep an eye on updates from the competent authority to make sure that the status of CBD hasn't changed and that it isn't considered to have medicinal effects, which will be particularly interesting once the FSA have carried out their own assessments on the safety of CBD.
Thanks, Hannah. So another interesting example there then of how the fluidity of different products and the different product sectors and their specific regulations. So, yeah, interesting. It is a medicine. It's not a medicine. It is a medicine for pets, but it's not a medicine for humans. Yes.
So looking a little bit at where regulation might be headed, there are concerns around the lack of regulation in this area, particularly given that it is a very controversial product. There have been concerns that companies are profiting from the supply of poor quality products with inaccurate labelling due to a lack of regulation. And there are also worries that companies are abusing the lack of regulation to make unsupported health claims. So what might we expect to see? Post the FSA review, we might expect to see a CBD-specific regime implemented, which would certainly bring some welcome clarity to this area. It's likely that we might also see some enhanced labelling and information requirements. The Centre for Medical Cannabis has highlighted that one of the key concerns for CBD products is inaccurate or wrongful labelling. In some cases, there were even found to be controlled substances within products, but of course this wasn't recorded on labels. That's an example of where consumers aren't being properly informed about what they are consuming. But in the meantime, before any regulation does change in this area, prudent producers can certainly be introducing voluntary measures and ensuring in particular that their labels contain all of the information about what that product does actually contain to enable consumers to use products safely and to fully inform consumers as to what it is that they are consuming. And I guess the key drive behind all of the future regulation and current regulation is just ensuring that enough information is being given to the consumer to enable that product to be safe.
Thanks, Anne. So we're back to litigation risks. So we've considered the regulatory regimes. We've discussed specific subsectors of food and CBD. And now we're just going to pan out slightly to litigation risks. Not specifically the regulatory ones, which we looked at, which generally result in fines and convictions for the companies, but don't particularly help anyone else that's harmed by non-compliance, for instance, consumers or others in the supply chain. And if we're looking at what the risks are, typically they'll fall into the two categories, the first two bullet points you have there, either failure to inform or warn, which will generally relate to the safety element, or they're misleading, inaccurate information, which picks up the broader consumer protection that consumers shouldn't be misled by claims that are made. We've spoken a lot about safety, so just briefly before going back to safety in terms of post-marketing monitoring and corrective action, in terms of misleading and inaccurate information that's provided to consumers, that will be protected by the consumer rights legislation. And if we take a particular example, which again is quite topical, of vegetarian and vegan products, although that is not an area that's yet a sector, has a sector-specific regime of regulation, the Food Standards Agency has issued guidance, which is often the precursor to a dedicated regime, which makes it clear that special care must be taken in food, in particular food production processes, to ensure there isn't cross-contamination with, in particular, animal-based products for those vegetarian or vegan products. But it's not just foods either. So there have been instances where other non-food products, for instance, a mascara has been criticised, being marketed as a vegan mascara, but it's had animal products. So, for instance, there was a particular case where beeswax was involved with a mascara that was marketed as vegan, and that resulted in the consumer being entitled to an apology and a refund. But coming back to the main area, really, in terms of risk, it will be where post-marketing monitoring of products has actually demonstrated that whatever information was provided with the product to advise of risks, and so that there is informed risk and informed consent on the part of a consumer, where in actual fact, post-marketing the product manufacturers receive feedback which tells them that consumers are not following whatever product information there is, or they'll typically use the product in a dangerous way regardless of the prominence of a warning which is on it. At that point, it's incumbent upon all participants in the supply chain, but again, most importantly for the producer, to consider what they should do about that, and if they can alter, if they can amend the product information or the warnings to make them safe based on the market intelligence that they've received, then all well and good. But if they can't do that and they can't make them safe, then they'll have to go to a further stage of considering redesign, or ultimately, if the product simply cannot be redesigned to make it safe, then they'll have to consider discontinuing that particular product. So, who can take action? Well, typically it will be the consumers. Consumers who are harmed can bring claims, for tortious claims that they've been harmed by the products. The regulators, as we've seen already, will bring claims, but that they won't help individuals. They will just result in fines to go to those authorities. But there are also others who have commercial claims and who have suffered some prejudice because of non-compliance, and it's affected their businesses.
You mentioned consumers, the individual claimants. Do you see there as being a move towards US-style class action litigation in the UK now?
Yes, is the short answer. We haven't seen such a sort of strong move towards class actions as yet. Typically, we have group actions in the UK. So, in that particular format, all of the claimants are individual claimants, but they just group together. Whereas the class action format, there's one individual who leads the class, and then others, either on an opt-out or an opt-in basis, get to benefit from the decision that's arrived at. The benefit for them, especially in this jurisdiction of a class action, is that they, if they're not a claimant in their own right in the action, they're not going to be responsible to pay the opponent's costs of the litigation if they lose. So that's a very important difference. We have class actions of a sort under the Consumer Rights Act. They're known as representative actions. And a particular example on which there was a Court of Appeal decision towards the end of last year was a case brought by Richard Lloyd, who was a former director of the consumer rights group Which, and he brought an action, a representative action, against Google on behalf of Apple iPhone and other Apple product Safari users. Because what Google had done, and it was some time back, had sold the cookie information from those browsers from the users, and they had sold them to advertisers who knew that they were interested in whatever the particular thing was, sports or particular food products or particular cars, and obviously the data was valuable, and they hadn't had the consent of the Google users to use that cookie information. And the class action was brought, and although the value, because there was clearly some value in the data because Google sold it to the advertisers, and so although it may not be a lot, by the time it's multiplied across all the affected Apple users, it will run into hundreds of millions. So it was used in that instance, but of course it's not inconceivable that the same mechanism could be used for consumers who have suffered prejudice because of defective products, or because they've been misled or not properly protected by product information. Another factor that has a bearing on potential group or class actions is that litigation funding is much more widely available now as well. And so you'll be ready to know my final slide. Why is compliance important? And we have the crying emoji. Keeping it very brief, damage to the producers and others' businesses, their brands, their reputation, criminal investigations and sanctions, very time-consuming, very disruptive, and very expensive and can have a big impact on share price. Other costs, so for instance, if there are criminal convictions, there will be knock-on effects for reputation and insurance premiums. So quite significant implications for non-compliance.
Could individuals fall into the realm of criminal investigations and sanctions?
Yes. Theoretically, individual directors of companies could find that they are being personally pursued and prosecuted. But that is quite rare. Most viewers will be relieved, I'm sure, to hear. And really, bar exceptional situations where there's been gross neglect, and usually it will be a sort of a sole director, sole trader type business arrangement where they have been particularly neglectful and they're essentially using the corporate structure as a shield. But where it's a large and, you know, responsible company that may have transgressed, there is already redress for the consumer because they have resources which the regulator can pursue and impose fines. But as I say, in the sort of sole trader company context, there is potential for abuse. And so in those instances, the regulators may decide to prosecute the individuals personally. Sorry, Nick. Back to Nick for the future.
Thank you. Bit of, as you said earlier, crystal ball gazing here. Sadly, I don't have an inside line to number 10 Downing Street, nor Dominic Cummings on speed dial. But that said, I'll do my best to give a bit of insight into what's going to happen next. And apologies again to those of you who are understandably suffering from Brexit fatigue.
Brexhaustion.
However, it is important to stay abreast of the latest position in respect of both the negotiations as they are ongoing during this transition period, i.e. to the 1st of January 2021, and what might follow on that date, either by way of deal or no deal, to quote Noel Edmonds. So the transition period, well, the EU law, as I'm sure you're aware, remains for now. Anything which takes effect prior to the 1st of January 2021 will have to be complied with by the UK for now, whether by way of direct effect or by inputting its own regulations into force. And this includes things like the revised medical devices regulations, which John referred to earlier in the context of the zero
contact lenses.
Yes. Now, another notable upcoming change, which you may be aware of, is the EU Blue Guide. This was last updated in 2016, and for those of you who are familiar with it, it provides important rules and interpretations of the EU product regulations, things like definition of first placing on the market, what's meant by a distributor, what is meant by a supplier. This is all important information in the context of assessing liability for compliance with product information and labelling requirements. The consultation ended on the 15th of January 2020 for that, and we'd expect a report forthcoming within the next few months, so keep your eyes peeled for that one. So what happens next in terms of a deal? Well, importantly, I'd say product safety and liability was never one of the core driving forces of Brexit, and as such, it doesn't appear to feature particularly highly on the negotiation list. And as such, the prevailing view is we'll continue very much in the vein of EU law in this area, whatever happens. Of course, the UK government, Boris Johnson, has indicated that we intend to diverge from EU law to reduce the burden of red tape. How much of this is rhetoric and how much is reality, of course, remains to be seen. there are scant details of any deal so far or trade deal, let alone the specifics of product liability and safety. But again, keep watching this space for updates. No deal, what happens if we hit December 2020 without agreeing anything with the EU? Well, we'll be in the position of a no deal type scenario. And in that context, we can look to the rather snappily titled Product Safety and Metrology, etc., Amendment, etc., EU Exit Regulations 2019, as amended by the Product Safety, Metrology and Mutual Recognition Agreement, Amendment, EU Exit Regulations 2019. What a mouthful. Notwithstanding the long title, it's quite a useful place to start to see where we might end up. And again, broadly speaking, we're going to end up in a fairly similar position to where we are now under EU rules. The most important element that I wanted to pick up on is the CE mark change. John has already said we've been familiar with this for in the region of around 40 years. And the proposals actually do have quite a significant impact, particularly in terms of testing, traceability and recalls. And again, in terms of information and labelling, whether or not you have to apply a CE mark or the UK equivalent following the transition period will be quite important. Now, prior to the withdrawal agreement being signed, the UK had proposed a UKCA mark to replace the EU CE mark, which again was fairly similar. Importantly, the UK had proposed a grace period within which it would still accept the CE mark. The EU had provided no reciprocal arrangement for that. So the key context of notified bodies is a further contentious issue in this regard, i.e. the body who's going to be assessing whether or not you have complied with the relevant requirements in order to be able to put the CE mark or the UKCA mark onto your product. Importantly, the UK's prior guidance has now been withdrawn from its website in relation to the UKCA mark, and it's one of the key points to watch out for in relation to the negotiations to see where we end up and to see whether we actually end up with both sides putting in place some kind of reciprocal agreement for transitioning. And again, just moving on to the last bit of our slides, there's a live recent developments in commercial contracts update talk similar to this one that's going to be taking place on the 9th of June 2020. Again, all useful stuff for Brexit readiness and just general updates in the area. And finally, I'd just like to say thank you for watching on behalf of all of us. This webinar is designed to help solicitors meet requirements A2 and A4. And you may also use the quiz which we've prepared, which can be accessed via the Take a Quiz link on the webinar details page to reinforce your understanding of the webinar content. You should answer 7 out of 10 questions correctly to pass, but we'll have 2 attempts. And please do feel free to submit survey feedback via the survey screen. This webinar will be archived immediately, but will be available to view on demand for 24 months. And a transcript of the webinar can be made available on request. So please contact Alexis for that. And thank you very much again for joining us.